You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So I want to introduce Kate. So Kate's a professor in the School of Interactive Art and Technology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. And the reason I invited Kate here is that I think she has an interesting take on sort of a background in anthropology and studying media, but has specifically been focusing on how indigenous cultures are sort of managing access and control and creative ownership of different kinds of intellectual property as different artifacts from cultures are being digitized and reappropriated and find lives in ways that were not sort of anticipated or suspected. So I will pass it over to Kate.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Mike, and thanks to all of you for being here today. I'm going to start off by describing a pair of images which situate some of the questions I have about access and ownership of what people are calling digital heritage, and then the role of collaborative ethnographic practices in the virtual museum. So this first image was taken in the summer of 2005. It's in the meeting room of the Doig River First Nation, who are a community in northeastern British Columbia. And I'm showing this photograph because it represents this very exciting moment for me. It was the beginning of a collaborative community-based production of a Virtual Museum of Canada exhibit about Dene'za stories and songs. And the project had been inspired by the return of a digital archive of Dene'za ethnographic documentation. So Dene'za is the name of this particular culture. It means the people in their language. So in the photograph, a group of elders had just come into the room, and the chief at that time, whose name was Gary Oker, had just unwrapped this cloth bundle, and inside was a moose hide drum skin that was painted with some imagery that had been created by a Dene'za prophet about 100 years before. So he's unwrapping it, and then this elder named Tommy Attachi is looking at the drum, and he's using it to talk about the history of these Dene'za prophets, the ways in which they've helped people to navigate life under colonialism, and articulating all the different ways that the drum itself is connected to oral traditions and Dene'za language and their knowledge of the land. But the image for me also represents this tension in the documentation of material culture, like the drum, and intangible cultural knowledge, like the knowledge he has of this particular artifact. So even though in the course of the project that emerged from this, this drum became very central to the way we collected information, to the way our process unfolded, the Doig River chief and the council and members of the community eventually decided that this drum and other related media should not be seen publicly online or almost anywhere else. So this moment, this sort of digitally documented moment for me represents this transition from locally mediated intangible knowledge to digital cultural heritage, and the ways in which these moments and documentations are becoming central to Aboriginal claims of ownership, cultural property, and self-representation. And then the second image was taken in 2009 at the Smithsonian Institution's Museum Support Center in Maryland. So in this picture, a delegation of Inuvialuit elders and youth from the Canadian Arctic, and then filmmakers and researchers like myself, were exploring one of the Smithsonian's founding collections called the McFarlane Collection, which was brought to the Smithsonian by a Hudson's Bay Company trader about 150 years ago. So the collection includes this wide range of Inuvialuit artifacts like hunting tools and clothing and artwork, and has become very important to contemporary Inuvialuit people. So in the image, we're making a film about this encounter, and we're planning a virtual exhibit that's going to circulate this collection more broadly than before, but it's going to be circulated on a Inuvialuit term, so from their perspective. So for me, these two projects represent two different contexts of ownership and of circulation. The Dene Za example is focused on the digitization and the negotiation of how to ethically circulate cultural documentation that had previously been limited in its analog form. And then the Inuvialuit Smithsonian example deals with a context in which images and information related to this collection have long been public as the property of a public institution and represented by that institution. But Inuvialuit people it's been almost impossible for them to access this collection in the past. So, you know, with both of these projects, digitization and circulation of the collections opens up these new possibilities for remediation of the digital records and also self-representation. One values the ability to limit circulation, while the other benefits from wider circulation. And then they also rub up against international heritage policies like the UNESCO Convention for the Safeguarding of Intangible Cultural Heritage, which promotes community participation in safeguarding efforts and determining how best to safeguard cultural practices, and the Charter on the Preservation of Digital Cultural Heritage, which really promotes digital content as the world's heritage, which can also come into conflict with the way people might think about how they want their media to be circulated. So I should say, you feel free to ask questions or jump in or interrupt me. I don't mind at all. But what I'm going to talk about is just sort of briefly situate the discussion of media in the museum context. And then I'm going to talk about this idea of remediation, which I'm just focusing in on today to keep things short, and the way I've been thinking about it in relation to something called virtual repatriation. And I'll talk more about these two projects. And I'll raise a couple questions, and I hope that you have questions, and I look forward to them. Many Canadian First Nations and Aboriginal organizations around the world are using digital media to revitalize their languages, to assert control over the representation of their cultures and their histories. The examples here, which you can't really see very well, but they kind of just are a range of projects from Kimberley Christian's work with Warramungu people in Australia, who are developing a cultural protocol-based digital archives, to Zuni projects aimed at reconnecting narratives to objects in the Cambridge Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology, to Isuma TV, which is Zacharias Kunick's online digital or indigenous media distribution hub. So there's that kind of work going on. And then, of course, museums, academic institutions, and researchers are embracing technologies for their ability to make collections more widely visible. So all of this has to be considered against our histories of collecting artifacts into intangible heritage and also tangible artifacts. So ethnographic collections in North America were largely collected under this salvage paradigm, or the belief that was reinforced with genocidal government policies that Aboriginal people were destined to disappear. So all of this had to be preserved for posterity. But of course, they have not disappeared. So legislation like NAGPRA, that's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, has created what curator Stephen Loring at the Smithsonian calls a climate of repatriation, in which the building of partnerships and between institutions and source communities, and then the forging of collaborations in the representation and culture of culture and history are both emphasized and promoted. So access to by these communities to their heritage in digital collections is coming to be known as virtual repatriation. And this is where my research and these two projects have been situated. So I've been looking at how material culture objects are being digitally photographed for online collections databases, and how documentation of intangible cultural heritage like photographs, audio recordings, video, etc., are being transformed into digital files. And so these technologies allow the communities in which they were originally recorded to access widely dispersed documentation of their relatives, their languages, and their culture, often for the first time. And so this is like a paradigm shift in the way that institutions can access and integrate, or can display and create access to their collections, and which Aboriginal peoples are able to access and integrate collections into their own media practices. So they're really providing possibilities for institutions to share ethnographic authority and also for communities to express themselves. But at the same time, the practices are raising questions about ownership and control of heritage and digital forms. So, you know, digital production and circulation are initiating this shift away from locally controlled and mediated forms of knowledge to often unrestricted sharing, appropriation, and remix, which is a concern for a lot of people. So Kimberly Christian, she's written here, part of the inclusion of new technologies in these ventures is about maintaining control, both technological and social, over how knowledge is cataloged, circulated, and cultivated. And so this is quite important in the realm of heritage safeguarding, because digital documentary practices, on the one hand, have the propensity to freeze or kind of lock down cultural practices by archiving them and making them inaccessible and keeping them out of circulation in everyday life. On the other hand, the kind of default of openness threatens the safeguarding of cultural practices by potentially countering or transgressing protocols that themselves keep practices alive. So, and this is something that museum scholar and Christina Krepps has called indigenous curation, this idea that that these practices are both themselves a kind of intangible heritage that must be preserved in order to maintain those traditions. So, ownership of digital heritage continues to be quite contentious because unlike the repatriation of material culture or human remains to originating communities or to individuals, the ownership of cultural heritage, of digital cultural heritage, is with very few exceptions returned to the communities when it's virtually repatriated. So we're talking about sharing copies as opposed to actually returning ownership to people. And this has been called a sort of middle ground of repatriation. So this has led me to ask a couple of questions. First of all, if this desire for repatriation or return is the desire to control representation as individuals or as First Nations or as Aboriginal people, then how does virtual repatriation by institutions and individuals either support or actually thwart efforts by Aboriginal people to represent themselves? And then secondly, how are these technologies being engaged by Aboriginal communities to articulate their own social, cultural, and political visions? And what potential do these movements bring for shifting these relationships of power between heritage institutions like museums and universities and then the communities of origin? So I've been thinking about this idea of remediation, so Aboriginal remediation of digital cultural heritage that's produced by the original collectors or owners of Aboriginal cultural property in museums or ethnographic collections. And both of the projects that I've introduced so far demonstrate these processes of remediation, but they show different ways of thinking about the circulation of digital heritage based on their particular histories of collection and then their contexts of remediation. And this is a quote from Gary Oker, who's just kind of talking about how both tangible and intangible heritage that's returned to a community has a lot of purpose for reuse and for self-identification. Yeah.
When you say remediation, do you mean remediation like remedying, or do you mean remediation like mediating something over again or in a new and different way?
Yeah, I'm talking about, there's probably a couple different ways of thinking about it, but I'm talking about it quite literally, like taking media that's been produced not by the community who it came from and taking that and reintegrating it, recontextualizing it in a new way.
Okay.
This is the first project, a virtual Museum of Canada exhibit called Dane Wajich, Daneza Stories and Songs. And this I co-curated and produced with Amber Riddington, who's a folklorist, and then members of the Doig River First Nation in northern British Columbia. So just a little bit background. So this is a community that sits outside of a small city in northeastern British Columbia that in recent years has grown a lot because of quite intensive oil and gas exploration in the area. And there's about 200 people who live on a small reserve. They settled here around 1950 after their first reserve was kind of underhandedly sold by the sold to the Department of Veterans Affairs for returning war veterans. And shortly afterwards, they struck oil. And I should say, so between 1975 and 2004, the Doig River Band and the Blueberry Band fought in court for compensation over these subsurface mineral rights that should have been held in trust for them but were inadvertently transferred to the settlers. So finally, in 2004, they were compensated for these lost revenues, and this gave them enough money to kind of create new infrastructure and opportunities for the band. So this supported the construction of a new band hall and then other culture and language projects. So one of these was the digitization of a collection of documentations of intangible cultural heritage from communities over the last 50 years by an anthropologist named Robin Riddington, who started there as a Harvard anthropology student many years ago. At the time of the digitization, the archive had about 5,000 photographs and 600 hours of audio and many hours of digital video. And so these document you know, many things, but people, places, oral traditions, language, and particularly the last Dunezah prophet or dreamer, whose name was Charlie Yahe. And I began my research there because I was interested in following how these newly digitized documents would be used in the community and then what that might teach researchers and other communities who are thinking about this as a form of repatriation. So the archive inspired a lot of interest in the community, and we started this project with a grant from the Virtual Museum of Canada. It had a very open participatory process, which was grounded in a long period of post-production and community review and feedback throughout the design process. And it was especially focused on training youth in video production who would actually do the documentation with us. The process of what to film and where to film it was defined by elders, like this person, who Tommy Attachi, who spoke in their language about the drum that I showed you in the first image, and other issues as a way of directing this process of documentation. So we traveled out to about 8 different places where people had lived and traveled and hunted, where people were buried, and places that stood out as significant, including. This is the one place we visited was the former reserve that had been sold to the returning veterans. This was a place where the dreamer who had made that original drum that I showed you in the first image had died and was buried. So we went there to record stories and oral histories at that place. So the exhibit really shows video recordings of contemporary sort of concerns and oral traditions. And those are juxtaposed with media from the archive, like archival recordings of songs. And the project, you know, really shows how the return or this virtual repatriation of this archive inspired community engagement with new media, and then through the production of the exhibit facilitated the remediation of this repatriated digital heritage, the kind of community-based process of recontextualizing and reclaiming documents of the past and then repurposing them to address contemporary concerns. But I want to highlight just a couple outcomes of the project, which I've been calling digital matters. So I'm describing them in relation to this particular project, but I hope that they kind of speak to broader issues at play in anthropology, but media and heritage and ethics. And here we had to contend with some of the outcomes of making these formerly limited documentations of culture and tangible cultural heritage suddenly public over the internet. So the first matter relates to the centrality of cultural protocols and then the ethics of managing digital heritage. So after this summer of filming with youth and traveling out all over the landscape, we worked on the production of this exhibit. And a photograph of this last dreamer, Charlie Yahe, holding a drum that had been made by this Prophet Gayen, hope you're not getting lost with all the names here. This was chosen for the homepage of the website. But very quickly, we started to hear objections from neighboring communities about the use of this image. Descendants of Charlie Yahe were asserting that their families should be able to enforce intellectual property rights to the images. And even more, the drum that was shown in this image was still in the possession of one of the descendants of Charlie Yahe. And he objected to it being shown in any context, digital or analog. He wanted to, you know, basically control how this drum was seen. Second, when we started to talk about exhibiting the drum that had been unwrapped and discussed at the beginning of our project in the community's museum, elders that we spoke with said that that would only be okay if we wrapped it up in a pillowcase or a flour sack and we exhibited it so that no one could see it. And so obviously Amber and I, you know, thought, oh, this looks like a problem for our web project, because people are saying now that this cannot be seen over the internet. So we started to talk to people, and they started to evoke the ways that these dreamers had cared for objects in the past, how they had kept them away from people, hidden to maintain their power. So they were commenting on these protocols in order to articulate restrictions on visual access to representations of these drums and other related drawings in the museum and in virtual contexts. So eventually it was decided that all the images of dreamers, drums, and drawings should be removed from our exhibit, and it was replaced with images of unpainted drums that are used today, like in the photograph behind me. And the chief and council agreed that the use of repatriated heritage would require permissions from the families of those depicted in photographs. And then when the families declined for this community to use those photographs, they were all taken out of the exhibit. But then the other issue is the issue of control. So, of course, even though these images had been restricted, of course, they still exist and they've become part of other projects online. And it points to this sort of visual paradox that while the data that's used in these new media contexts can generate articulations of rights like the ones I've described, they also, you know, at the same time amplify the difficulty of enforcing those rights. So even though the community made the decision about the way it should be shown, it still shows up in multiple manifestations and remixes. I don't know why the Boston Red Sox is in there. So, for example, there are many examples, but a website where Charlie Yahe and the drum have kind of become part of a rotating flash animation, and a documentary film was shot in the process of digitizing that features these most beautiful, evocative images of this dreamer and this drum. So, the other sort of irony of the effects of this virtual repatriation is that these descendants of Charlie Yahe, who've cared for this drum according to a cultural protocol and kept it out of public circulation, in fact had their ability to control how it's shown most compromised by its documentation and digitization. So if the goal of these kinds of projects is to help to maintain local practices, then this can undermine that goal. Okay, so I'm going to go on to the next project, a project called the Inuvialuit Living History Project. This is a web-based collaboration with my colleague Natasha Lyons at the Inuvialuit Cultural Resource Center in Inuvik in the Northwest Territories and the Smithsonian's Arctic Studies Center. So this is an incomplete project. It's in the works, and the slides I'm showing you are from our prototype, but it represents, it's emerging as an interesting counterpoint to the Deneza project. So as opposed to the remediation of formerly private intangible heritage, which with the result of community restriction on some elements of that media, the Inuvialuit project is a remediation of a public institution's collections data with the desire by Inuvialuit people to represent it on their own terms and to make it more public in that way. While the Riddington collection was boxes of tapes and reel-to-reel recordings, photographs, the Inuvialuit McFarland collection is stored here and very pristinely conserved in the Smithsonian's Museum Support Center. And in 2009, this delegation traveled from Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk in the Canadian Arctic to spend a week with the collection, documenting it, thinking about how to bring home a collection that at this time cannot be physically repatriated. So you know, people took a lot of pleasure in handling the artifacts, talking about them, remembering how they were used before, and thinking about how they're continued, how they continue to be used today. We worked with the Inuvialuit Communication Society to make a documentary called A Case of Access, which is about this first Inuvialuit encounter with the collection and the kind of cross-generational transmission of knowledge. Question? Nope. Okay. So an example of some of the work that was done there while in contact with the collection was the tracing of clothing patterns so that these objects could be recreated at home and sort of, you know, you want to call it remixed with the new materials and techniques, but drawing inspiration from the museum collection. So this was exciting for people, but it was a real priority to try to create better access for Inuvialuit people and the public to this collection. So to that end, we requested that the Smithsonian make their digital records of the McFarland collection available over a museum network called the Reciprocal Research Network. And this was co-developed by four Northwest Coast First Nations and the Museum of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia, launched just last year. And so it's a collaboratively designed web portal that allows visual access to dispersed Northwest Coast collections at international partnering museums, from you know, Canadian Museum of Civilization to the American Museum of Natural History and Oxford and so on. So before the RRN, you'd have to, you know, if you were in your community and looking for heritage that was collected at some point, you'd have to search each of these databases individually, but instead you can see all those records at once based on certain search terms. So we worked with developers of this network to create a Inuvialuit exhibit of the McFarland collection that could actually, you know, remediate it and repurpose these records. So this was the McFarland collection online before. And then through the RRN, we're developing this prototype, which really acts as a documentary of the trip to the Smithsonian, as a source of information about the history of the McFarland collection and how it came there, and as a searchable archive of the collection that categorizes the artifacts in ways that make sense to people, Inuvialuit people, and which also supports local goals for like language revitalization and culture revitalization and representing contemporary life more broadly. So things like being able to search the objects in the Siglatan dialect, which is the dialect of the region from which the collection, the artifacts were collected, and dividing them into types and themes that were determined in collaboration with members, team members and educators. So this is a picture of these librettes that people used to wear in their cheeks. As a kind of adornment, but the priority of the project is to create greater visual access to the collection and to learn about how the Smithsonian has been caring for the objects, but also to show the collection to the world in a way that conveys the ongoing significance of this collection to Inuvialuit people today, something that we're doing by relating documentary images and documentary video of the visit and people handling those objects to the digital artifact records and to ongoing community activities. So we wanted to, that's Mervyn, we wanted to make the Inuvialuit experience of encountering these objects in the museum part of the experience of collecting the, or of accessing the collection online. And also to hear directly from people who participated in the trip and in the ongoing project, you know, their experience of the collection and then the process of the production as it unfolds. And then, as with this Dane Wajic project, it's been the process of project consultation and collaborative development and design that's opened up these conversations around intellectual property, these histories and regimes of ownership of objects, and then the potential to actually repatriate the collection back to Inuvialuit territory. And it's really the sharing of the Smithsonian's records with the Inuvialuit Cultural Resource Center and their remediation of the collection and the collaborative production process that's facilitated these conversations on a broader level and enhanced the relationship between the institution and the communities with to what effect, of course, still remains to be seen. So just to finish up here, in both of these projects, it's what I've been trying to sort of point out the significance of local participation in determining the way in which Aboriginal intangible knowledge and representations of material culture are managed and circulated in digital form. And in talking about control over these ventures, again, I'm referencing Kimberly Christian. She's arguing not for the locking down of culture and media, but for the ethical circulation of media. So her work and then the projects that I've presented here also start with this goal of the design and collaborative production practices that support the ethical circulation of digital heritage and then the mobilization of digital heritage in self-definition and in addressing these unequal relations of power in colonial and post-colonial contexts that still persist. So a couple of questions for you, a couple of questions I'm thinking about that can get us started. I'm wondering how this idea of the ethical information circulation practices of local communities inform these broader debates about, you know, lockdown and openness, and how are these local practices relevant to global practices? Because I've been arguing that these are really significant at the local level for people, but what do they mean in your worlds, or when we think about it in other contexts, does it matter? And also, how and then in what context can these ethnographies of the digital cultural production, you know, these moments when things are transformed, how do they illuminate these broader power relationships, like between museums and communities, for example, and many, many other contexts? And then how can our ethical design practices avoid the replication of prior structural inequities? Because it's very easy for a museum to simply turn their own way of categorizing information into a digital world that doesn't actually capture the potential of that technology to do things differently and involve people who have a real stake in that, in their heritage in those institutions. So thanks for listening to me for the last 30 minutes, and I look forward to your thoughts. Yeah. Thanks. Actually, I just want to take a second to show this slide, because the projects I've been talking about were very large collaborative projects. So I'm one person in the production of these projects, and I just especially want to acknowledge Amber Riddington for the Dene Wadjic project, and Natasha Lyons, Chuck Arnold, and the Inuvialuit Cultural Resource Center, who's working hard this very moment on that project. Thanks. Okay, so there's my questions.
I have a question about your two opening images.
Yeah.
Were those images of the same culture taking two different positions on access and sharing, or one culture?
Those are both Canadian Aboriginal peoples, but one is from the Inuvialuit community in the, like, very, very far north, as far as you can get north in Canada, and the other one is from a subarctic community in northern BC. But they would have, you know, different ideas about what should be made public and what should.
That was really my question then. Yeah. So if they have a different position or a different attitude toward sharing,
yes,
do you attribute that to their cultural differences, or is it because they are in different situations and one of them can only have access to the Smithsonian collection by virtue of digital sharing and the other,
yes,
one can have more immediate access? Or would you say that these cultures experience a kind of internal ambivalence about sharing and access?
Well, first of all, yes, you make a good point, and this is what I'm thinking about a lot right now, is that these are very different contexts I'm comparing, I'm holding up next to each other. And of course, within communities themselves are diverse, and people have very different opinions. So someone older will have a different opinion than someone younger. Someone who's more actively engaged in traditional practices will have, you know, an idea that might be different from a young artist who wants to use these ideas and images in new ways. And then there's the question of, you know, intangible documentation versus tangible objects that have traveled and are physically situated in a different place. So the questions people are asking and the way these ideas play out in relation to those different contexts, of course, you know, there's a lot to think about there. So, yeah. Don't know if that answers your question exactly. But
I can accept that there's a diversity or plurality of views inside each one of those cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But it would help me to know a little bit more about why the first group resisted sharing. That is, what's their objection exactly?
Yeah. This has a lot to do with the history and the context in which the object or the intangible, you know, kind of ephemera mm-hmm. was collected. So the McFarlane collection at the Smithsonian was purchased by a trader. So people came and sold items that were legally acquired by the Smithsonian Institution. And in general, they were not sacred. They were not sensitive elements of cultural property that were acquired, with the exception of maybe a few things in that collection. The intangible is a little more complicated because someone is recording you or photographing you, and you may not have knowledge of how that is going to be used in the future, especially like 60 or 70 years in the future. So the objection is that this media was recorded, but perhaps never should have been documented in that way. And while it has a great value to people locally, they're very, you know, happy, it's important to them to see those images. But they want to keep that media circulating in relation to appropriate social practice. There is disagreement in the community about that, but that's the bottom line for now in relation to that project.
It sounds that maybe I'm reading too much into what you said before, but the way then to decide sort of which side of the fence you come down on when there's disagreement is defer to the person who allowed you access to the artifact or to the intangible, right?
Yeah, please.
So I was just saying that, and this is probably pretty typical of what you see even with websites, right? Is they say you can access our content, but here are our rules about what you can do with it. And
mm-hmm.
so I don't know if that's sort of the protocol that you follow, or that is, if there's a difference of opinion within the community about how you can use something, is it just simply who had it in the first place gets to decide, or
yeah,
how do you manage that?
Complicated.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a clear answer, but it depends on the kind of administration of authority in particular communities. So those are also different from community to community, the way certain people are given authority in communities to make decisions like that. So in this case, it went with the opinions of elders and then the chief and council listening to them and making a kind of a conservative decision for now. That doesn't mean it won't change in the future. And I think part of this is the desire to use media because they're powerful for telling the world your story and who you are. But there's also this need to consider and reconsider how best to use those tools in the service of the goals that people have for it.
About why you mentioned that, especially in the context with the drum, that it was viewed as an intellectual property conflict, and I'm wondering why the conflict is being viewed in that frame. Why is it being viewed as an IP conflict when it seems that, at least in that case, the IP holder in that case is, I assume, dead, or the rights have passed in some sort of traditional legal sense to either into the public domain, and I'm wondering if this has to do with Canadian IP law specifically, or whether it was an actual decision made to view these conflicts in an intellectual property context.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the context is kind of an interesting one. That when the person, the anthropologist, let's say, who clicks the shutter on the camera, who makes the recording, becomes the owner. Holds the copyright to that particular recording. And that really doesn't make a lot of sense when what they're recording is likely a shared, say, oral tradition. It doesn't actually belong to the speaker. It belongs more communally to that particular community. People sort of are bearers of that tradition, but they wouldn't claim to own it. But then suddenly the person who makes the recording owns the copyright. So part of the reason for talking about those these issues in terms of intellectual property is that that's the only claim of ownership that can be made realistically to claim that the intellectual property, say, of related to a photograph of a family member would then become somehow the responsibility of the descendants.
And it seems like it would almost make more sense to just simply reject that structure altogether and say, we do not buy into these ownership systems. So then I still don't understand why they're choosing to pursue that frame and say, we are looking at this as a transfer of intellectual property as merely saying, no, we reject this concept of intellectual property altogether.
Well, they may very well be doing that. I think there has to be a way to make claims. But, I mean, people aren't really talking in the language of intellectual property and copyright. And people aren't necessarily, you know, looking at law, but they are trying to find ways to make claims and to have a response to those claims. So it becomes framed that way, but I think you raise a good point. It's not necessarily the most appropriate language.
You spoke about involving local communities in the creation of these documents, but I was wondering, it would seem to me as a student of anthropology too that the most empowering thing would be to teach people how to use these technologies themselves.
Yeah.
And maintenance of websites and maintenance of collections, and so then you remove the middleman who's determining who has access and actually allowing them themselves to have those discussions. I was wondering if any of your projects are involved in like youth media training or anything like that. I mean, I know you said they filmed, but that's for the documentation itself, not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of that project was youth media training, leading to that, you know, actual filming of the project. And with the Anubi Alouette project, we brought youth with us to the museum. That was sort of a conscious decision to have them be involved in the film that was made by the Anubi Alouette Communication Society. So they, for example, already have a full TV documentary radio production studio, they produce a magazine. So they're all set up to produce media. I think the question for this project was connecting and engaging and finding ways to facilitate the group coming together. But I agree with you, and we've really tried in these projects to make training a central part of production. The websites, you know, are always a challenge. You know, finding resources to compensate someone to maintain and to keep the projects going is a real challenge, and it's definitely a limitation in that way.
This might not be, my examples might not be specifically relevant to the communities you discussed, but I am wondering about sort of the power dynamics, and it seems that a lot of the concern, both from you as a researcher and among the indigenous people, is in reaction to the previous context of abuse. And that leads me to wonder how much of your response is kind of determined by that context and how much is really indigenous to the indigenous people. So, for example, the drum used to be kind of secreted away from people looking at it, but that itself was a power structure. Maybe there was a certain caste of people that couldn't see that object, perhaps women couldn't see that object. So when you make that choice, you're still making a choice of sorts, and it kind of goes back to, well, you know, the chief has access to it or something, but have you confronted any of those sort of scenarios?
Well, I think always there are, you know, especially, you know, in tradition, there are embedded relations of power that persist for better or worse. So I haven't made it my role to actively contest those things or to raise them, but more to work with people to, you know, produce these exhibits in a way that is most comfortable and appropriate for them at that time. So, yes, some in the community might argue that these things need to be seen. You know, they're important to be seen. They should be shared widely. And they don't believe in the reasons that are being, you know, presented to restrict them. So I think there's always a conflict that way. But I haven't tried to confront it in terms of changing the outcome of the production.
So, and is that a kind of standard anthropological ethical stance?
Well, I don't know. I can't
answer
that.
I'm just curious.
I think, you know, there's no pretense of objectivity in being a part of producing these projects collaboratively. So definitely, you know, my interests and our group's kind of dynamic affects the outcome differently than if someone in the community took this on themselves. So our collaboration changes the outcome. But I don't think I wouldn't press chief and council to do things differently myself. Yes?
Could you talk a little bit about the effort of collaborating, how long it took to set up the relationship before you got the project underway?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the Dunezah project, I talked about anthropologist Robin Whittington, his partner Jillian Whittington. So they've been working in that community for more than, I think, around 50 years. And their daughter, Amber Whittington, was the co-producer. So this is a very long, continued, sustained relationship. And I was brought in, you know, as a graduate student and someone who could teach video and web design. And that's how my relationship began. So I was, you know, privileged to come into a community that already had a long relationship. But this project we filmed in the summer of 2005, and we launched it in 2007. So it was, you know, a summer of filming, and then over those 2 years, production and design and community review.
Who funded the project?
The Virtual Museum of Canada. And then we also had funding from the Volkswagen Foundation for Endangered Languages at the Max Planck Institute. There's a lot of translation and orthographic transcription of those narratives to subtitles, so that was a long process. And then local, you know, organizations funded the video production and youth training, that kind of thing. And then the Smithsonian project has a bunch of different funders, the Museum Assistance Program in Canada, the Prince of Wales Northern Heritage Center in Yellowknife, and a project which gave us the seed funding called the Intellectual Property Issues in Cultural Heritage Project at Simon Fraser University, which is a sort of a big consortium of people working on intellectual property and cultural heritage issues. And this project, again, Natasha Lyons is an archaeologist who's worked with the Inuvialuit community for many years, and so she started this project and the trip, organized this trip to the Smithsonian, and then that's when I joined the project to work with documentation and facilitating the web production. Yes?
Can you comment a bit more on what is, if anything, is uniquely unique in the digital context for on the control issue, meaning how have anthropologists and museums dealt in the past with communities' preferences for how their artifacts are represented mm-hmm. and made available?
Yes, good question. You'll see, for example, if you search the collections online on the Reciprocal Research Network or, say, at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC, you'll see sometimes you know, the symbol, like the red line through the camera, you know, and say, like, no photos permitted. Often in these digital contexts, the record will be there, but you won't be able to see the image because it's been deemed culturally sensitive. And this emerges out of the building of new relationships. You know, someone needs to be able to talk to that curator and say, that is a sacred, you know, object, and it shouldn't be seen. It never should have been collected, and we want you to keep it and take care of it, but it shouldn't be on view. Even in the collections themselves at the museum, this might be covered up with a sign that says this is a culturally sensitive object. Even, you know, at the Peabody, there's an Australian Aboriginal object that has, like, a lid on it, and it says this may be culturally, this is a culturally sensitive item and shouldn't be viewed by certain people. If you want to see it, you can lift up the lid, but otherwise it's hidden so that someone isn't inadvertently offended by seeing it. Projects like I mentioned, Kimberly Christian's work in Australia, you know, the actual code of the digital archive allows people to determine how they view the contents and what kinds of restrictions should be placed on media. So what's really interesting to me is how these projects are rewritten and recoded in a way that doesn't necessarily assume certain structures that might contravene or disrupt the way people might want media to actually circulate in real life. It should, back to sort of like UNESCO conventions that talk about culture as safeguarded only through practice. it's helpful if the media that is put to task in the service of safeguarding actually supports the ethical circulation of media in a particular way. So it's not easy to do. And I see lots of interesting projects out there. And I think the Smithsonian project is a little bit different because there aren't necessarily objects in the collection that need to be restricted because this particular community right now wants to make them very public, and they're already a long public collection. But other contexts have more sensitive issues to deal with, and ideally the software supports that.
I found it interesting to know what's the actual level of involvement that the community has in maintaining the product of the project. As you mentioned, the rights in the product remain with you guys, not with the community. Or did I get it wrong?
Okay, so the Virtual Museum of Canada project is all copyrighted by the Doig River First Nation. So everything that was recorded in the course of that project was the property of the band. The Inuvialuit project is interesting. We're remediating the Smithsonian's digital records, but still all the content says copyright Inuvialuit Cultural Resource Center. So there's new media that's produced, and that also sort of becomes the property of the Inuvialuit Cultural Resource Center. By definition, in the past, media that was produced by anthropologists was copyrighted by the anthropologist. But today, it's more common to share copyright or even to give up copyright after the research is finished. So it's not something that people necessarily protect, although people still do own copyright to ethnographic material. But I think part of this climate of repatriation and the kind of spirit of building relationships doesn't mean that you need to hold on to copyright and ownership in the way that people might have before.
Mm-hmm. So you might offer it back to the community in the future in order to allow them a greater degree of control?
Yeah, and these projects already, I think it's owned by the community. My research, for example, I share copyright of certain things, which really just means I have permission to use the material in my research. But I also return it to the community. Yeah.
I just had a very interesting conference on public-private distinction with privacy as its focus. And in that connection, we're thinking about the public domain. And now, in a sense, when you're advancing the interests of Aboriginal people, you're speaking of a form of privacy. It's a form of privacy that's more like a secrecy or a privilege. And is it in your thought to be honored as an ethical appeal? Is that the idea, to articulate the ethics of Aboriginal claims on what would otherwise be someone else's copyrighted work,
mm-hmm.
or the public domain?
I think these projects and other projects are asking for a kind of reconsideration of the ethics of circulating media that ask for a rethinking of what openness means. So, open access doesn't need to be the default, and that particular kind of local systems of knowledge management and circulation can be thought of as an option for the way that these communities define themselves online. So, people don't need to be excluded from using the tools, especially if they can recreate the tools in the service of a particular ethical framework for sharing. So privacy might be a part of that for some people, and the ability to document and archive material that doesn't necessarily need to be seen. It might be kept offline and out of circulation versus other material that could be widely circulated because of its ability to advance particular claims or to express identity. So I think it is a some kind of an ethical appeal.
But not a legal appeal.
This is another question. I think in some contexts, of course, it becomes a legal appeal. So going to court, for example, to prevent Aboriginal artwork from being commodified and sold on coffee mugs, or protecting the rights of artists, it does become a legal situation. But it depends on the context and the degree to which people feel it necessary to engage the system in which they're situated.
We'll be around. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.